Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take a stack of dense sources and extract the knowledge nuggets you need to be perfectly informed. Today, we are wading into what our sources universally describe as, well, probably the most contentious debate in cognitive science.
Yeah, it's been called ferocious, even tear-filled, which gives you a sense of the stakes. We're talking about the poverty of the stimulus, or POS.
Right, POS. It sounds technical, but it hits right at the heart of how we become human, doesn't it?
Nah.
Linguistics, psychology, philosophy, they all clash here.
Absolutely. And our mission today for you listening is to really clarify this. We want to break down what POS actually is, why it's sparked decades of debate, and crucially, how it shapes our understanding of language development.
And specifically, the arguments for and against it. We're going deep on the evidence today.
Exactly. So let's start with the core idea. At its heart, POS is a developmental claim. It's about the information, the data, that's available to a child learning language.
Okay.
It basically says that sometimes the language a child hears, the stimulus, has this unresolvable ambiguity, meaning the input, the sentences they hear, could logically support more than one grammatical rule or structure. The stimulus is insufficient on its own, as the sources put it. It's a classic induction problem, going from examples to rules.
So the kid hears stuff, but that stuff is compatible with, say, grammar A and grammar B, and the input doesn't tell them which one is right.
Precisely. And the reason this is such a big deal isn't just the ambiguity itself, it's that kids solve it. They reliably end up with the correct grammar.
Ah, okay. That's the kicker.
That's the picker. This is the phenomenon our sources call constrained generalization. Children somehow figure out the right, very specific linguistic knowledge, even though the data they got was, well, technically compatible with wrong answers too.
They don't make the errors you'd expect if the data was truly ambiguous.
Exactly. How do they avoid those tempting, logical, but wrong paths? That's the mystery POS forces us to confront.
Okay, let's really unpack the logic here then. Because the argument for needing some kind of innate knowledge, or at least some internal guidance, it flows directly from this logical structure. It's quite a neat four-step argument.
It really is. Step one is simple. Data. Everyone agrees children get external data. They hear language being spoken around them. This data is what they use to learn the underlying representation, the grammar.
Straightforward enough. No arguments there.
Step two is the controversial bit, the claim of poverty of the stimulus. This external data, the sentences they hear, are compatible with more than one hypothesis about the underlying grammar. Crucially, the data don't uniquely point to the correct hypothesis.
That's the unresolvable ambiguity we talked about.
Exactly. Then step three is the empirical observation, constrained generalization. Despite the ambiguity in the data, children consistently figure out the correct specific grammar. They avoid the other possibilities the data were compatible with.
They land on the right answer.
They do. Which leads inevitably to step four, the conclusion, prior knowledge or abilities. Since the external data wasn't enough to single out the right answer, the child must have something internal, some prior knowledge, some built-in inductive bias that pushes them towards the correct generalization and away from the errors.
So if you can prove steps one, two, and three, step four just follows logically.
That's the power of the argument, and it's why establishing that POS, step two, actually happens in real language learning is so critical. That's where the fight is.
Right. To make this ambiguity really clear,
yeah.
Let's use that visual analogy mentioned in the sources, the figure one idea. It really helps visualize the problem.
It does. Imagine a space representing all possible grammatical rules for some aspect of language. The actual sentences a child hears are like beta points. Let's call them X's, scattered in this space.
Okay. I'm picturing points on a map.
Good. Now imagine several different hypotheses, different possible rules that could explain these X's. Let's call them hypothesis A, B, C, D, E, and F. These are like different shapes drawn on the map.
And the X's fall inside these shapes.
Exactly. And here's the crucial part. All the observed X's fall within the boundaries of all these hypotheses, A, B, C, D, and F.
Oh, hearing the X's doesn't help the child choose between A, B, C, D, E, or F. They all fit the data perfectly.
Precisely. Now, let's say hypothesis C is the narrow, correct rule for English. And hypothesis F is a much broader, incorrect rule. Maybe one that allows sentences English speakers never actually say.
Like an overgeneralization.
Right. Since every X the child hears is compatible with both C and F, there's no single data point that tells the child, hey, rule F is wrong.
So if a child just learned from the data, they could easily pick F. and they might never realize it's too broad.
That's the logical problem. Why would they ever narrow it down from F to C if the data never forces them to? If they stuck with F, they'd make mistakes, produce ungrammatical sentences.
But they don't. That's the constrained generalization.
Exactly. They converge on C, they avoid the tempting error of F, and that convergence, that needs an explanation beyond just the input data. It points to something internal, something prior. So the whole debate really hinges on showing this ambiguity isn't just theoretical, it's real.
Okay, so let's dig into what insufficient data really means in practice, because, you know, people argue about this constantly. The traditional argument is about data just literally being missing.
Right.
That's what we can call type one. The data just aren't there. This aligns perfectly with that core definition we started with. It means the specific examples, the data points that would uniquely pick out the correct hypothesis, they're just absent from what the child typically hears.
And the classic example of this is the subset problem. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. The subset problem occurs when the correct hypothesis, let's call it C again, is a subset of a bigger, incorrect, overgeneralized hypothesis. FC is nested inside F.
So everything allowed by C is also allowed by F, but F allows extra stuff too.
Exactly. Think about why word questions in English. The correct rule, hypothesis C, says why words generally need to be at the front of the clause, like what did the penguin see? Or I know what the penguin saw.
Okay, standard English.
But imagine an incorrect, broader hypothesis, F, that says why words can be at the front or they can stay in situ, meaning where they'd be in a statement, like the penguin saw what, used as a regular statement, not an echo question.
Which sounds wrong in English, yeah, ungrammatical.
Right. Now, every single correct sentence the child hears that follows rule C, each word at the front, is also perfectly compatible with the broader incorrect rule F, which allows both fronted and in situ.
Ah, I see. So there are no sentences that are okay by C but forbidden by F.
Precisely. There are no C but not F examples in the input. So if a child somehow started with the broader hypothesis F, nothing they hear would ever contradict it. They'd have no positive evidence forcing them to shrink their hypothesis down to the correct, narrower rule C.
That creates the unresolvable ambiguity. Logically, they could just stick with F forever.
That's the classic POS argument from the subset problem. It seems logically airtight.
But modern approaches, especially from people who aren't keen on innate language rules, they have ways around this, don't they, using statistics?
They do. This is where things like the size principle come into play. The idea, proposed by people like Tenenbaum and Griffiths, is that children might be doing sophisticated probabilistic reasoning. They might use the ambiguous data itself as indirect evidence against the broader hypothesis F.
How does that work if the data fits both?
Think about it this way. Hypothesis F, the big, broad rule, predicts a huge range of possible sentences, including lots of weird, ungrammatical ones. Hypothesis C, the narrow rule, predicts only a small, specific set.
Right.
If the child only ever hears sentences from that small, specific set predicted by C, even though those sentences are also compatible with F, a smart statistical learner might reason. If the rule was really the big F, I should be hearing a much wider variety of sentences by now. Since I'm only hearing this very restricted set, it's much more probable that the true rule is the narrow one, C.
So the very lack of hearing the broader examples becomes evidence against the broader rule. That's clever.
It is clever. It uses the absence of evidence as a form of evidence. But, and this is crucial, it doesn't eliminate the need for prior knowledge. It just changes what kind of knowledge is needed.
Right. Instead of needing an innate rule about words, the child needs an innate ability for complex Bayesian inference, applying something like the size principle.
Exactly. The prior knowledge shifts from being language-specific content to being a powerful, possibly domain-general learning mechanism.
Okay, so that covers the lack of direct positive evidence. What about other kinds of evidence, like negative evidence, parents correcting kids?
Right. So direct positive evidence are the X's, the examples of correct sentences. Negative evidence is information about what's wrong. Now, explicit correction, a parent saying, no, don't say it like that, is actually pretty rare for grammar. And famously, kids often ignore it anyway. Classic work by Brown and Hanlon showed that.
Yeah, I remember reading that. Kids care more about truth than grammar.
Often, yes. So the focus shifted to indirect evidence. This is data that requires the child to make an inference. A common example is recasts.
That's when the parent repeats the child's sentence, but correctly.
Yeah. Child says, her eat cookie. Parent says, yes, she is eating the cookie. For this to work as negative evidence, the child has to notice the difference, infer that their version was wrong, and figure out the rule from the correction.
That sounds like it requires pretty sophisticated processing.
It absolutely does. Which brings us to another key reason why POS can occur, even if the data is technically out there. The usability of data.
Meaning the child just can't process it yet.
Exactly. Think about the language adults use. Some sentences are really complex, maybe with multiple embedded clauses like, the cat that the dog chased climbed the tree, that, right. You know, it gets complicated. Let's call these complex bits the H points for hard to use. A young child's developing brain, their working memory, their ability to parse syntax might just not be able to handle those H points yet. Even if those sentences are in the input stream, they fly right past the child. They're effectively invisible.
So the child is only learning from the simpler sentences they can process, the S points.
Right. And if that smaller set of usable data, the S points, is still ambiguous, if it doesn't contain the crucial examples needed to rule out incorrect hypotheses, then the child experiences POS. It's poverty caused not by the environment, but by the limits of the child's own processing system at that stage.
That makes a lot of sense. The effective input is smaller than the total input.
Definitely. Now, the sources also mention two other kinds of problematic data, often lumped in with POS, but they're a bit different. Noisy data and misleading data.
How are they different from the core type 1 ambiguity?
The key difference is how they affect the correct hypothesis, C. Remember, type 1 POS is about ambiguity. The data fits both C and the wrong hypothesis, F. Types 2 and 3 are more about data that might actively make the child think C is wrong.
Okay, give me an example of type 2 noisy data.
Noisy data endpoints are just errors. Maybe a parent misspeaks, hesitates, or maybe the child hears a non-native speaker making systematic errors, like transferring a grammar rule from their first language.
Like hearing someone consistently put who words in situ in English.
Exactly. If a child hears enough of that noise, endpoints, it might actively contradict the correct rule C. It doesn't just create ambiguity, it might push the child towards the wrong rule F or make them discard C altogether. It distorts the picture.
Okay, so noise actively misleads. What about type 3, misleading data?
Misleading data, M points, are utterances that are actually grammatical in the language, but the child misinterprets them. The classic example is echo questions.
Like, you did what?
Right, that's perfectly fine English, but its grammar is exceptional and it depends heavily on the intonation, the prosody. If a child misses that special prosody, they might take that M point as general evidence that, hey, putting what at the end is okay sometimes.
And that again contradicts the narrow, correct rule C for standard questions.
Exactly. So both noisy data and misleading data can confuse the learner, potentially leading them away from the correct hypothesis. While they can contribute to ambiguity, their main danger is actively pointing the child in the wrong direction. The core POS argument, though, the one that logically forces us to assume prior knowledge, is still that type 1 ambiguity, especially the subset problem, combined with usability limits.
Right, because that's where the data truly underdetermines the grammar.
So if we accept that POS exists, that the input is ambiguous, and that kids still get it right, constrained generalization, we're forced to conclude they have some kind of prior knowledge or ability guiding them.
The internal bias.
The internal bias.
Yeah.
Now, the huge debate, the one causing all the tears, is about the nature of this prior knowledge. Is it innate? And if so, what kind of innate?
Because prior could just mean learned earlier, right? Like maybe kids learn basic statistics first and then apply that to language.
That's a fair point. You can have derived prior knowledge. But the argument, famously pushed by Chomsky and others, is that if you trace any derived knowledge back far enough, you eventually hit rock bottom. You hit something that wasn't derived from earlier experience.
The starting point.
The starting point, the biological endowment. Everyone agrees humans have some innate biological endowment for language. After all, you can expose kittens or rocks to language all day long and they won't learn it. Children do. So something innate is required.
Okay, so innateness isn't really the question. It's what is innate.
Exactly. That's the core split. On one side, you have linguistic nativism. This is the view most strongly associated with universal grammar, yeah. UG. People like Chomsky, Hornstein, Lightfoot, they argue that at least some of the innate knowledge required to solve POS is language specific.
Meaning it's knowledge or abilities only useful for learning language, not for anything else, like a dedicated language module in the brain.
Precisely. UG, in this sense, refers to those specific built-in linguistic principles or structures. And for the linguistic nativists, the burden of proof is, in a way, lower. They just need to find one piece of necessary innate knowledge that can't be explained by general learning mechanisms. If they find one specifically linguistic thing, they win the argument against pure empiricism.
Okay, so what's the other side?
The other side is non-linguistic nativism, which often travels under the banner of empiricism, though it's a sophisticated empiricism. Thinkers like Clark, Lappin, Chater, and others, they absolutely agree there are innate abilities. They have to.
Right, the up-to-his-neck-innate mechanisms idea from Quine.
Exactly. They accept innate biases. But they argue that all the necessary innate abilities are domain general. These are things like powerful statistical learning mechanisms, pattern recognition, memory capacity, maybe a general preference for simplicity or efficiency, things useful for learning lots of different things, not just language.
So they believe language is learned using the brain's general purpose toolkit, which happens to be innate.
That's the idea. Their challenge is much bigger, though. They have to show that every single instance of constrained generalization in language, every BOS problem, can be solved using only the input data combined with these non-linguistic innate abilities. They can't allow even one little piece of language-specific innate knowledge.
That sets up the battle lines pretty clearly. Specific linguistic instincts versus powerful general learning tools.
It does, and it leads to some really interesting ideas about how POS might interact with language evolution itself. Simon Kirby's work is fascinating here.
How does evolution fit in? Does it favor one side?
Kirby's model suggests something really cool. POS might actually cause children to have the right innate biases over evolutionary time. It's a feedback loop.
Yeah, explain that.
Imagine parents produce language that's ambiguous. That's the POS situation. Their kids, facing this ambiguity, are forced to rely on whatever internal biases they happen to have. Let's call the bias the purple ellipse, like in the sources figure 5 analogy.
So the ambiguous data forces them to use their bias.
Right. The bias then guides them to settle on a specific underlying grammar, the purple one. Now here's the twist. When these children grow up and have their own kids, they produce language based on the grammar their bias led them to adopt.
So they produce ambiguous data consistent with the purple grammar.
Exactly. And the next generation of kids who inherit the same purple bias, encounter the same ambiguous data, rely on their bias, and converge on the same purple grammar again.
Wow. So the language itself gets shaped generation after generation to fit the learner's biases.
Precisely. The bias doesn't just help learn the language. It helps create the structure of the language over time. The ambiguity, POS, forces reliance on the bias, and the bias then ensures the language stays stable in a form that the bias can handle.
That kind of turns the problem on its head. The bias works because the language has evolved to match it, driven by the constant pressure of POS.
It's a really elegant evolutionary perspective on why our innate predispositions and language structures might be so well suited to each other.
Okay, now let's pivot to the arguments against POS, or at least arguments that say maybe the stimulus isn't so poor after all. If we just look closely enough or assume smarter learners, this often gets quantitative, right? Trying to figure out how much data is really enough.
Exactly. The earliest attempts at this were these formal learnability approaches, famously starting with Gold's work in 1967.
Ah, yes, Gold's theorem. That caused a huge stir, didn't it? Often cited as proof POS was real for language learning.
It was, but often misinterpreted. Gold showed that certain formal classes of languages couldn't be learned in principle just from positive examples without negative evidence. People jumped from that mathematical result to saying, see, human language needs innate rules.
But the assumptions were key.
Hugely key. Gold's setup required the learner to succeed on any possible sequence of input data, even deliberately tricky adversarial sequences designed to fool the learner. That's not realistic.
Right. Kids learn from typical input, not from someone trying to trick them.
Exactly. The takeaway from Gold isn't that language is unlearnable, but that learnability results depend heavily on the assumptions. If you make the learning problem unrealistically hard with false idealizations and the learner fails, it doesn't tell you much about real learning. Conversely, if you make it harder and the learner succeeds, then you know the easier real problem is definitely solvable.
Okay, so Gold was maybe a red herring. What about more recent formal approaches?
They've become much more sophisticated. For instance, Clark and Lappin later argued that learners could potentially solve many POS problems, even subset problems, if they employed a powerful strategy. Basically, treating things they don't hear as evidence that those things are ungrammatical.
So using indirect negative evidence based on frequency.
Essentially, yes. Interpreting low probability as ungrammatical. if a certain sentence type compatible with the broader hypothesis F is logically possible but just never seems to occur in the input after hearing tons of data, the learner might implicitly conclude it's not allowed.
That sounds like the size principle again, almost.
It's very related. It again shifts the burden. You might not need innate linguistic rules, but you do need a potentially innate learning strategy, this ability to use statistical absence as negative evidence. It solves POS, but still requires a specific kind of built-in learning ability.
Okay, moving from formal proofs to actual child development, how do researchers use the timing of learning as evidence?
This is the developmental benchmarking approach, really pushed by Leggett and Yang. The core idea is pretty intuitive. Things that are harder to learn from the input should take longer.
Makes sense.
So the hypothesis is that the age at which a child masters some piece of grammar should correlate with how often they get clear, unambiguous, positive evidence for it in their input.
The challenge there must be defining unambiguous evidence.
Oh, absolutely. It's painstaking work. Researchers have to carefully define exactly what sentence structures would count as clear proof for a specific rule. Then they analyze child language corpora, like Childies, to estimate the frequency of those structures. Maybe it's, say, 1.2% of the input.
And then they see when kids typically master that rule, maybe age 3.
Right. That gives you a baseline. 1.2% frequency leads to mastery around age 3. Now, the crucial test is when you find another piece of knowledge, let's call it Kalis, which has much lower frequency of unambiguous evidence in the input, maybe only 0.1%.
Okay.
But you find that children master Kalis just as early, also around age 3, as the rule K-more, which had much more frequent evidence.
Ah, so the learning speed for Kalis is faster than the data frequency alone would predict.
Exactly. That discrepancy is the evidence for POS regarding Kalis. The child must be using something other than just the frequency of unambiguous data, some internal bias, to speed up the learning of Kalis and acquire it so early despite the sparse input.
That's a clever empirical way to detect the influence of bias. But what about cases where unambiguous data is essentially zero, like maybe the word subset problem?
Right. Benchmarking relies on some unambiguous data. For true subset problems, we need something else. This brings us to arguably the most powerful quantitative tools used today. Information theoretic approaches, often using the minimum description length, MDL principle.
MDL sounds complex, but the core idea is about simplicity.
Exactly. MDL comes from information theory and basically says that the best hypothesis is the one that provides the most compact description or encoding of both the hypothesis itself and the data observed so far. It assumes learners have an innate bias towards simplicity or efficiency.
A domain general preference for compact explanations.
Precisely. Imagine, again, you have two hypotheses, C, the complex but correct one, and E, a simpler but incorrect one.
Like maybe E is move the first auxiliary and C is the complex move the main clause auxiliary.
Good example. Initially, storing rule E is cheaper. It's simple. Storing the complex rule C costs more mental storage space up front. But now the child starts hearing sentences, the data, the X's. The correct complex rule C might allow you to encode or predict this incoming data very efficiently. The simple but wrong rule E, however, will keep running into sentences it can't explain easily. It has to keep adding exceptions or patches.
So the total cost of using E, the simple rule plus all its messy exceptions, starts to grow rapidly.
Exactly. While the cost of C, the complex rule, plus the efficiently encoded data grows more slowly, MDL calculates the break-even point, which the source is called D break-even. That's the amount of data you need to observe before the total cost of the complex but correct hypothesis C becomes less than the total cost of the simple but incorrect hypothesis E.
The point where complexity pays off because it handles the data better.
Precisely. After you've seen amount of data, the rational efficiency-seeking learner should switch to hypothesis C.
So how does this test for POS?
Researchers calculate this data how much data is needed for the MDL learner to pick the right rule. Then, crucially, they translate that amount of data into an age.
How do they do that translation?
They use estimates of how much language children hear per day or per hour, drawing on studies like Hart and Risley's work on word exposure, combined with estimates of waking hours. This gives an expected age by which a child should have encountered DEFL data points.
Okay, so the model predicts an age of acquisition based purely on data and the simplicity bias.
Right. Now, if that predicted age from the MDL model is way later than the age children actually acquire the rule, like the model says it should take 500 years to figure out want a contraction based on data and simplicity alone, but kids get it by age 5, then you've found POS.
Because the simplicity bias alone wasn't enough to explain the speed.
Exactly. It means the child must have additional biases beyond just preferring compact descriptions that are helping them converge on the right answer much, much faster than the data alone would allow. These quantitative methods really force the debate onto empirical ground. All right, so moving from the methods to the actual battleground, specific linguistic phenomena. Case studies are absolutely vital because they force everyone to get really concrete. You can't just vaguely talk about language. You have to define the specific rule, the competing hypotheses, the actual data available, and what abilities you're assuming the child brings to the table.
This is where we see if these quantitative methods actually work and what kinds of biases seem necessary. Let's start with the big one, the classic, syntax structure dependence.
Right. This is often seen as the bedrock argument for linguistic nativism. The problem, as we touched on, is how kids learn to form complex yes-no questions. They need to learn the rule isn't linear. It's not move the first is or can you find.
It's move the auxiliary verb that belongs to the main clause, which requires understanding hierarchical sentence structure.
Exactly. Like in, is the dog that is chasing the squirrel happy?
Mm.
You move the first is, but in the dog that is chasing the squirrel is happy, the is you'd move to make a question is the second one. It depends on the structure.
And the initial POS argument was that the simple linear rules, move the first O, would work for most simple sentences kids hear, making them seem like the obvious choice based on frequency. Yet kids somehow learn the complex, structure-dependent rule very early, around age 3.
Correct. It looked like a slam dunk for POS needing innate structural knowledge. So naturally, researchers tried to knock it down by arguing the data was sufficient.
Tell us about that first major attempt, Rialli and Christensen, back in 2005. What was their idea?
They argued that kids could figure it out using simple statistics specifically, the frequency of word pairs, bigrams, and triplets, trigrams, across all the language they hear, not just questions. They claim that the statistical patterns in everyday sentences implicitly favor structure-dependent interpretations, even if the child doesn't consciously know the rule.
So no innate syntax needed, just a powerful statistical learner tallying word sequences. Sounds domain general.
It did, but that claim didn't hold up for long. Later work by Kam and others showed that Rialli and Christensen's result was likely a statistical artifact of the specific data set they used. When tested on larger, more representative language samples, those simple word statistics weren't reliable enough to distinguish the structure-dependent rule.
So the ambiguity remained. The simple stats weren't enough.
It seemed not. The purely statistical solution didn't quite work. This pushed researchers back towards needing some kind of bias, but maybe still a domain general one. That led to the work by Perforce, Tenenbaum, and Regeer.
What did they propose?
They took a broader view. Instead of just looking at yes-no questions, they treated structure dependence as an overhypothesis, a general property likely true of the entire grammatical system. They used Bayesian modeling and found that, yes, POS still exists for this problem, but it could be solved by a domain general simplicity bias.
The MDL idea again.
Essentially, yes. A preference for the grammar that provides the simplest, most compact overall explanation for all the language data. A system built on structure dependence, while complex locally, might be simpler overall than a system relying on lots of linear rules and exceptions.
So domain general simplicity could still win, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
But then the pendulum swung back again with Abend and colleagues.
It did. They took an even broader perspective, trying to learn not just syntax, but also how syntax relates to logical meaning using context. Their model succeeded, but the bias it needed was interesting. A preference for rational rules.
Rational rules, meaning?
Rules that are not only simple or compact, but also tend to reuse common building blocks or operations. Efficiency through reuse. Now, the bias itself prefers simple, reusable rules. Sounds pretty domain general.
Yes.
But the kinds of building blocks their system needed to reuse to successfully learn structure dependence looked suspiciously like abstract linguistic primitives, things related to thematic roles, argument structure, the link between syntax and meaning.
Ah, so the learning engine might be general rationality reuse, but the parts it needs to operate on might be language-specific innate knowledge.
That's the interpretation that supports linguistic nativism. It's a subtle point. Is the crucial innate part the general learning strategy or the specific representational units it works with? The debate continues there.
And finally, the neural network approach by McCoy and others. What did that show?
They showed that certain types of neural networks could learn the structure-dependent rule without being explicitly programmed with hierarchical syntax, which sounds like a win for the anti-innate crowd.
But it's not that simple.
It's not. Because the network architecture itself, how the nodes and layers are connected, the learning algorithms used contains implicit biases. The success of the network doesn't mean no bias is needed. It just means the necessary bias might be embedded in the structure of the learning mechanism rather than explicit rules. It still reinforces the core POS conclusion. You need some internal constraint to get structure dependence right. The debate just shifts to where that constraint lives.
Okay, so syntax remains a complex battleground. Let's shift gears. What about a case that seems to lean away from linguistic nativism, like learning number words?
Right. Lexical semantics, learning the meaning of exact cardinal number words like 1, 2, 11, 97. The learning target here is the cardinality principle, or really the successor function, knowing that the next word in the count list means exactly one more.
And the POS argument here is?
The input is incredibly skewed. Kids hear 1, 2, 3 constantly, but higher numbers are much rarer. It follows a power law distribution. So the data is arguably insufficient to robustly teach the infinite, perfectly regular plus one system, especially distinguishing it from alternatives like maybe it's base 10 or maybe there are weird exceptions for large numbers.
Yet kids do learn it. But it's a staged process, right? They go through being a one-knower, then a two-knower.
Exactly. They learn the meanings individually for small numbers, and then suddenly, usually around age 4 or 5, they make this inductive leap and understand the whole system. They become cardinal principle knowers.
So how was this modeled? Did it require language-specific knowledge?
This is where Pianodossi and colleagues' work comes in. They built an ideal learner model that remarkably reproduced that exact staged learning trajectory. And the key finding was that it did so using only assumed domain general building blocks.
Like what?
Things like basic comparison, is this set bigger than that set, combinatorial abilities, can it combine concepts, and crucially, recursion, can I apply a rule repeatedly? These feel more like general logical or mathematical primitives.
Not specifically linguistic units.
Correct. And the driving force was, again, that rational rules bias preferred the simplest, most compact system that reuses components. In this case, the successor function, plus one, is a beautifully simple recursive rule. Because both the building blocks and the simplicity bias seem domain general, this case study is often cited as strong evidence for the non-linguistic nativist view. It shows general cognitive abilities might be enough for some complex learning.
Interesting. Okay, one last case study. Phonology, word final, obstruent devoicing. Like in Dutch, hund, sounding like hunt.
Right. The rule is basically, if a consonant that blocks airflow, an obstruent like BDGVZ, occurs at the very end of a word, pronounce it as its voiceless counterpart, PTKFS.
So hond, dog, with a D sound, gets pronounced with a T sound. Where's the potential POS here?
The ambiguity, as it's already pointed out, lies in the scope of the rule. Does the child learn the precise rule, devoice obstruents only when word final? Or do they learn a simpler but wrong rule, like always devoice D at the end of a word, or maybe even devoice all consonants at the end of words?
How would they tell the difference?
They need evidence where the sound isn't word final but might seem like it, or where a final sound that isn't an obstruent stays voiced. For example, hearing the plural honden, where the D is followed by a vowel and stays voiced, is crucial evidence against the rule being just always devoice final D.
Okay, so does the input reliably contain enough of that contrasting evidence?
That's the open question. Whether POS actually exists here depends entirely on detailed analysis of Dutch child-directed speech corpora, which, according to our sources, hasn't definitively resolved the issue yet. We know adults generalize the rule correctly to new words, so children do reach the constrained generalization.
So this is a prime candidate for those quantitative methods we discussed earlier.
Absolutely. You could apply the developmental benchmarking approach. See if the age of acquisition matches the frequency of unambiguous evidence like honden. Or you could use the MDL rational rules approach. Calculate the Dorbonk point for learning the precise rule versus simpler alternatives based on corpus data.
And the result would provide more evidence in this ongoing nativist debate. If general simplicity works, it's a point for non-linguistic nativism. If it requires assuming innate phonological features, it's a point for linguistic nativism.
Exactly. It shows how these specific, concrete case studies are where the real progress is made. Hashtag tag outro. So, wrapping this all up, what's the big picture? I think the real value of the poverty of the stimulus concept, honestly, goes beyond just settling the nativist debate. as important as that is.
How so?
It highlights a fundamental truth about learning, especially language learning. It's a hard problem. The input children get is often noisy, ambiguous, and incomplete. POS isn't some rare edge case. It's likely a frequent challenge children overcome constantly.
It forces us to appreciate the sheer power and sophistication of the child's learning mechanisms. That constrained generalization is kind of miraculous when you think about the messy data they start with.
It really is. And the way forward in understanding it seems clear now. It requires rigor and quantification. No more hand-wavy arguments.
Right. You need to, as the sources stress, one, precisely define the specific learning problem. What's the target rule? What are the plausible alternatives? What data is actually available?
Then two, quantitatively measure if POS is actually occurring for that specific problem. Use tools like developmental benchmarking or calculate that Devon point with MDL. Is the data mathematically sufficient given reasonable learning assumptions?
And third, if POS is confirmed, you need an existence proof. Show exactly how a specific proposed learning mechanism with its specific biases can provably solve that specific instance of POS using the available data.
Exactly. Being explicit about the hypotheses, the data, the learner's abilities, and the biases, that's how we move beyond the shouting matches.
Looking at the solutions we've discussed, particularly from the quantitative modeling, it's striking how often these domain general biases like simplicity or MDL or rational rules seem to play a key role.
They definitely do. They're powerful explanatory tools.
Yet, as we saw with the structured dependence case, even those general biases might need to operate on some kind of pre-existing, perhaps language-specific representational structure to work properly for syntax.
That seems to be the cutting edge right now, understanding that interplay between general learning mechanisms and potentially specific representational formats.
Which leaves us with a really provocative final thought for you, the listener, to chew on. We've framed the debate as linguistic nativism versus non-linguistic nativism. Linguistic nativism wins if even one crucial piece of the innate toolkit is language specific.
Right.
But what if we push the non-linguistic idea even further? Could it be that all the seemingly language specific structures or biases, like the innate expectation that syntax connects systematically to meaning, or the preference for hierarchical structure itself, could themselves be derived from one single, even more fundamental, non-linguistic bias?
Like what kind of bias?
What if the brain's most basic drive is simply a preference for maximal similarity across all its different representational systems? Imagine the brain wants the way it represents visual scenes, the way it represents concepts, and the way it represents linguistic utterances to all use similar structural principles, hierarchy, compositionality, recursion, because that's maximally efficient overall.
So the pressure for syntax to be hierarchical wouldn't come from an innate syntax module, but from a deep-seated drive for syntax to look like vision and conceptual structure.
Exactly. Could that single ultra-general bias for cross-system similarity be powerful enough to bootstrap all the specific structures we observe in language without needing any of them to be explicitly innate linguistic knowledge? That's something to think about.
A potential grand unification theory for cognition. Definitely something to explore further.
Thanks for joining us for the deep dive.